which we present to you all, thus supporting the efforts of the organizers too. On this subject, Radio Mystore deeply recorded all the speeches given at the said conference, and in order to publicize them, they have been produced and are available online to facilitate their use for podcasts, community radios, and broadcasters which specialize in pacifism. We sincerely hope that this undertaking serves to focus on the most important area in the world against war and for peace, the elimination of nuclear weapons. Now we are going to listen to the International Humanitarian Law of the Advisory Opinion, since the work by the government on the last 50 agencies by the government's freedom from nuclear weapons, through the accountability of faith. Hans Weber is a member of the Family of Peace Council, Dennis Cotton.
I would now like to ask Hans Lammerent from Bomb Spotting to give us his contribution to our conference today. Hans.
Okay, thank you. I think if you want to evaluate the advisory opinion and in what way or what merits the advisory opinion has for, let's say, campaigning against nuclear weapons, we have to look at what discussions were about the implementation of international humanitarian law and how the court or which discussions the court solved in a certain way. The court indicated the two cardinal principles of international humanitarian law, and as it was indicated before, these were not under discussion. All nuclear weapon states accepted that these rules were applying to nuclear weapons. There was much more discussion on how to implement these rules in to judge specifically weapons. And that's where the court in the end ended with an indecisive decision. If we look how those principles are implemented in Protocol 1, in Article 51, we see there are different ways to, first of all, implement the principle of distinction between the use of weapons have to distinguish between civilians and combatants. They're worked out in different ways. First of all, a prohibition against conducting attacks against the civil population as such. And second, the obligation to keep this distinction at every moment and to safeguard the civil population as much as possible. This is then implemented in three different ways. First, an indiscriminate attack is one which is not directed at a specific military objective. The second, an indiscriminate attack is one which uses a method or means of combat which can't be directed at a specific military object, the targeting test. And third, an indiscriminate attack is one which uses a method or means of combat where the effects can't be limited. When those methods or means are not judged as indiscriminate as such, belligerents have to respect the necessity and proportionality conditions. The question here is, how far are these different implementations part of customary law? Contested issues in the past were if there, let's say, exists something as an indiscriminate weapon. Several states defended the position that only indiscriminate methods of combat existed. That means what is important is how you use a weapon, and you can't judge beforehand if a certain weapon is indiscriminate as such. Another discussion were, let's say, what tests you have for an indiscriminate weapon. And then the contested issue there was in what way the effects have to be counted in. The second principle on unnecessary suffering, there we have, let's say, seen in the past the same sort of discussion on does there exist a weapon which by its nature causes unnecessary suffering. If we see to the negotiations around Protocol 1, there have been several conferences of experts where they tried to make up the, let's say, the state of international humanitarian law and see what was customary, what was already in there. And there you see those different issues popping up. Is there something like an indiscriminate weapon? Do effects have to be counted in? And when the Protocol 1 was negotiated, several states added an explanation of their vote with Article 51 to state that according to them, that article didn't mean there was such thing as a non-discriminate weapon. If we look to what positions the nuclear weapon states defended before the ICG, we see that on one hand, some states, France and Russia, in fact, their position came down to denying that there was something like an indiscriminate weapon, so that you can't make at all a judgment beforehand. With the arguments of the US and the UK, you see that they use the targeting tests in their defense before the court. So there it's a bit unclear if they accept something as an indiscriminate weapon by its nature, because on the one hand they also say that you can't judge in a weapon in abstract, but on the same hand they use also the targeting test. That shows a bit the state of what were the art of what the nuclear weapon states were defending. If you then look on what the court has decided in its advisory opinion, they make very clear that according to them, there exists something like a weapon which can be indiscriminate according to its nature. For state the first principle, they say that states may never take civilians as a target of an attack and may thus never use weapons which can't make a distinction between civil and military targets. The same is done on the principle concerning unnecessary suffering. Again, they say that it's prohibited to use weapons causing them such a harm or uselessly aggravating their suffering. In a way, that is clearly making a decision in that discussion beforehand. And according to me, that means that you can judge a weapon before any envisaged use, if it's illegal or not, according to that principles. That doesn't mean that once you've made such a judgment, that there can't be afterwards, if you judge a weapon is not indiscriminate, that it can't be used indiscriminate, but then you come to the proportionality and necessity rules. A second, which I think important thing, is the mentioning of the effects inside the opinion. It's not, let's say, stated that clearly as the issue around the weapons, but the court states the effects on environment, states that the characteristics of nuclear weapons are such that they can't be contained in either in space or time. So there, at the same time, you can see that the court uses in the body of the advisory opinion the tests of the effects, of if effects are can be used. I think there you can see the merits of the advisory opinion, that it at least closes discussions on, or at least gives its very authoritative opinion on certain discussions around international humanitarian law, which existed before the advisory opinion. The court could not decide whether nuclear weapons were illegal weapons or not. It stated that it didn't have the necessary knowledge of facts at its disposal to come to such a final conclusion. But it clarified the customary roles, and from that clarification follows that an evaluation beforehand is possible for specific nuclear weapons. That means if you have a specific nuclear weapon, you can look on what are the effects. People who have the knowledge, states who deploy such weapons, can judge beforehand if that weapon is indiscriminate or is causing unnecessary suffering. So the argument the nuclear weapon states were using is that they couldn't judge in abstract is clearly negated by the court. If you then look at the conclusion or the application the court made themselves of those principles, we have that strange wording that the court can't come to a decision in an extreme circumstance of self-defense in which the very survival of a state would be at stake. I think it's important to show that there is a coherent reasoning possible, although it's strangely worded. It's not contradicting, or you can interpret it in a way that it's not contradicting with the body of the advisory opinion. And that's then, in a way, the interpretation which is valid. If you see in the first parts of the dispositive, it stated that the rules of the UN Charter has to be met. So the only moments you could possibly use nuclear weapons is in a situation of self-defense. Then further on, they say that the threat or use of nuclear weapons has to be in accordance with international humanitarian law. So if you then look to that conclusion, why does self-defense show up there? In a way, as a limiting part, they sum up, as I read it, the conditions under which the situation is limited where the court can't come to a decision. That means in a situation of self-defense where the very survival would be at stake, so in that condition, in that moment, they can't do the balancing because they don't have the facts at their disposal. So that's a very limited situation where the court can't come to this conclusion. It's important to read it in such a way and not as a sort of balancing of the rules of self-defense against the rules of humanitarian law, for which the advisory opinion has been criticized, because it gives a coherent reading with which you can explain what are the decisions the court has made, the conclusion the court has made on international humanitarian law, and you can advance on that. Important as well with that conclusion is also to read what the judge Bejawi said, that in his opinion, you can't judge in advance nuclear weapons as a category without a treaty as illegal. But he clearly says that according to him, the existing nuclear weapons were illegal and indiscriminate. So that means he leaves open the possibility that in the future science will develop other nuclear weapons which are not indiscriminate, which don't cause unnecessary suffering. That means if you want to state as a legal whole category of nuclear weapons beforehand, you need a treaty. There are chemical weapons where, for example, the tear gas police uses is considered as a chemical weapon, but you can say, would that meet the conditions in a war situation? The reason why riot gases are also prohibited is to avoid the confusion in a war situation that chemical weapons are used. So that's the difference between specific weapons and weapons as a category. What I think is the importance of this is that with the existing rules of humanitarian law, if you apply them to the specific nuclear weapons which are deployed, which use is envisioned for, you can say that with the existing rules, those weapons are illegal. Those weapons are indiscriminate and cause unnecessary suffering when used. So it's important to place the burden on the nuclear weapon states that they have to make that evaluation and they have to prove their case. If they state you can't judge a weapon illegal in abstract, the same thing applies for the legality. You can't judge such a weapon as legal in abstract. So they have to prove that their specific nuclear weapons are legal weapons. And the court clarified which rules of international humanitarian law apply there. States have, they know what are the consequences of their weapons. I mean, that knowledge is spread even to every pilot flying a plane because he has to know how to avoid the consequences of the use of nuclear weapons himself, so they know exactly what's the effect of the bomb they drop. The states have their own In the Cold War, the pilots even had their target. They know it much in advance where they would fly. And now states have their targeting databases so they can judge the use for the specific nuclear weapons they have with the rules how clarified by the International Court of Justice. I think it's important to point to that fact. The law is clear enough to come to an evaluation and to press states that they have to do it. When we look then to the broader issue, the nuclear weapons policy, like this was before use, it stated already the court made there a second very important clarity. It linked the law of self-defense to the rules of international humanitarian law. So if you read through that part, the paragraph 42 and what follows on article 2, paragraph 4, then it's quite clear that the moment envisaged weapon use is illegal according to international humanitarian law, that you can't deploy it. And that states have the duty to check the legality of the weapons they want to use in such cases. If NATO says, for example, that it doesn't want to make clear beforehand what sort of, or in what situations they want to use nuclear weapons because that would give an advantage to the enemy, that's something they can say as long as their envisaged weapon use is legally in order. And that's where they have a case to prove first. To end up, I want also to point to something else in international humanitarian law is Article 1 of the 4 Conventions of Geneva says that the contracting parties have to undertake to respect and to ensure respect for the present convention in all circumstances. This is also considered as customary law. And if you look to the commentary of the International Committee for the Red Cross, the adding of the words to ensure respect was to strengthen that duty, that states have to prepare in advance, let's say in peacetime, the legal materials or the other means of loyal enforcement of the convention as and when the occasion arises. So when states are confronted with the fact that something like the International Court says that what the position they defend before the court, that you can't judge a nuclear weapon beforehand, when the court makes another decision, they have to check the legal status of their weapons and they have a case to prove, namely that their envisaged weapon use is legal. I think it's important to say that's also an issue of compliance in good faith in this time of international humanitarian law. So when we talk about good faith, we don't only have to talk about the NPT, but about the way how they deal with international humanitarian law themselves.
On the 31st of July 2006 at Radio Minsk Studios in Belgium.